Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Our speaker is Marius Busemeyer, professor of political science at the University of Konstanz, Germany. Professor Busemeyer's lecture is titled A Loud But Noisy Signal: The Role of Public Opinion in Education Policy Making. We begin with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe Director Kathy Jo Martin.
I'm just delighted to introduce Marius Busemeyer, whom I've known for many years. Marius is a professor of political science at the University of Konstanz in Germany and has done really exciting work on comparative political economy and welfare state research generally, as well as a sort of special interest in vocational education and training and education more generally. Marius also has written on theories of institutional change, and in recent years has been looking at public opinion and public policy. Marius studied political science, economics, public administration, and public law at the University of Heidelberg and the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He holds a PhD in political science from the University of Heidelberg. He also worked as a senior researcher with Wolfgang Streck and Kathleen Thielen at the Max Planck Institute in Cologne, and has held visiting professorships and fellowships at places such as the Center for European Studies at Harvard, the WZB Berlin, the Nuffield College at Oxford, the Department for Economics at the University of Paris, and the Amsterdam Center for Inequality Studies. Marius's most recent book is Skills in Inequality, that came out with Cambridge University Press in 2015 and was also winner of the Stein-Rokan Prize for the Comparative Social Science Research. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Marius. And thanks so much for coming today.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Kathy, for the nice introduction and, of course, for the hospitality and for having me here again. I just remember the last time I came here, I was actually giving a talk on that book that you mentioned on skills and inequality. So maybe this is sort of history repeating itself, because today I want to talk again about a book project that I'm working on. And it's basically the attempt to bring together research of a project that lasted for about 5 years. And it's about the role of public opinion in education policymaking. And I'm working here together with my collaborators, Julian Gabritzmann and Eric Neimans from the University of Konstanz, which I also like to mention here. So this is a project which has two big parts, and I'm going to talk about both of these parts today. And the first part of this project is about what public opinion education policy looks like across Western European countries. We did a big survey of public opinion, representative survey of public opinion in 2014. I'm going to tell you some more details about it later, where we studied issues such as support for academic or vocational education, general support for education spending relative to other social policies. We paid special attention to trade-offs in policy preferences for education, for old versus new types of social policies. This is tying into the debate about the social investment welfare state that is very prominent at the moment in Europe. I'm going to show some of the main findings from this first phase of the project later on. And then the second phase of the project has been to conduct case studies, qualitative case studies in these countries, although we focus mostly on 4 of the 8 countries that we're covering in the survey. We did interviews with policymakers, representatives from interest groups, political parties, to understand how does public opinion really matter? To what extent do policymakers take public opinion into account when they decide about education policy? And what are the mechanisms actually that explain how these public attitudes get transferred into policymaking? Because we have a lot of research nowadays on the dynamics of public opinion, public attitudes towards the welfare state on the micro level of preferences, but we actually don't really know exactly how this is then connected to public policymaking. We just have an idea that there's some correlation going on, but we don't know when this correlation is more robust or when it is weaker, and we don't really know how exactly via which mechanisms these attitudes get transferred into policymaking. So this is the goal of the project, more broadly defined, and this is also the plan for the talk. So this is the initial framework for our project, basically, because we're really interested here in the macro linkage. We want to understand how given policies and institutional context shape attitudes on education policy, and this is discussed in the literature using the term policy feedback effect, so how the state of education, of a state of education systems, how that influences what you think about the education system. That's an old argument in the historical institutionalist literature, and in more recently many people have applied it to the study of public attitudes towards the welfare state. We want to see whether we can see some cross-national differences in attitudes and whether these cross-national differences are related to different institutional designs of the education system. We are focusing mostly on level of public investment in education relative to other social policies, the distribution of spending and other resources across different education sectors. And thirdly, which I think is a really new thing also in the survey that we did, because we didn't have any public opinion data on this before, we want to understand public opinion on governance questions regarding the education system. So basically, whether people want to have more decentralized governance structure in education or whether they want more centralization, whether they are in favor of a comprehensive school model or whether they're in favor of more tracking in schools, and especially in European countries, there are lots of differences between education systems. Some, such as the German system, they have much more tracking onto different streams, and other countries, Sweden, Scandinavian countries, they have just one comprehensive secondary school for everybody, something like the comprehensive high school that you have here in the United States. And then, as I said, this is then going back again to the macro level, how these attitudes influence policymaking, whether policymakers actually pay attention to public opinion when they make decisions about education policy reform, whether they are more driven by partisan constituencies or whether they are more driven by party politics, or whether actually organized interests such as teacher unions, parental associations, and all sorts of other organized interests are decisive in shaping education reforms. And you can find, if you go through the scholarly literature on a public policy, you can find arguments that all of this matters, right? I mean, there are some people who make a strong point that party politics, and including myself, I've written about this before, shapes education policy, and other people, for example, Terry Moe here in the United States, he believes that, or he argues that teacher unions and other organized interests are very important in shaping outcomes. So it's quite open, I think, in the literature, what is really the more important factor here, and we try to provide an assessment on what really matters here. So I will have the first part of the talk will be more about this, and then hopefully if there's some time, but I try to be sort of efficient about this, I will have some examples about this part from the case of Germany. And we did interviews in Sweden and Spain and the UK, which were done by Julian and Eric, my collaborators on this project. So I'm mostly focusing on the German case because this is the case study that I did. But so I will present some major findings from this thing, which is the first phase of the project, and then some empirical examples from case studies in Germany. So just to go back one step and look at the scholarly literature in this field, there is a huge literature on the role of public opinion and policymaking. Much of it has been written about the case of the United States. More and more people are looking at this comparatively. There's a very influential theory by Stimson et al. And many others who have followed in the footsteps of Stimson et al., this idea of dynamic representation, which is actually a very simple idea. Policymakers are responsible to their electorate, so they basically do what the public wants, also in between elections. And actually, this literature, by and large, confirms that policymaking is, to a certain extent, responsive, and that there are certain biases towards the interest of privileged groups. That is more recent research by Marty Gillens and Benjamin Page and many others who are looking or trying to find out whether this responsiveness of policymakers is conditional in the sense that those in the upper income strata are more privileged when policymakers take public opinion into account. But that's one big literature. Recently, there is a little bit of this actually in the welfare state literature, especially Philip Rehm's work, but Brooks and Mentzer who have also looked at the relationship between public opinion and policymaking, especially in the welfare state area. And they also argue that public opinion matters for policymaking. And then you have this other big literature, partisan theory, interest groups, which is more coming from the traditional welfare state, comparative literature, Evelyn Huber, John Stevens, Esping Anderson, Manfred Schmidt, Frank Castles, who making a slightly different argument in the sense that this literature states that policymaking is responsive to certain to the balance of power between political parties. And that's a little bit of a contradiction between these two theories, right? So on the one hand, if policymaking is responsive to public opinion, that's basically saying policymaking is responsive to the median voter because public opinion is essentially what the median voter thinks or the majority of the population. But partisan theory says, no, actually, there's only partial responsiveness, and normatively speaking, that's actually regarded as a good thing. And so in a way, the normative implications of these two theories are conflicting each other because the public opinion literature would say a responsive democracy that responds to what the median voter thinks or the average voter basically is a good democracy, and the partisan literature, which I think is more common in Europe because the parties just play a much bigger role in the political systems in Europe, basically says the opposite, and in the sense that if you find that party politics or that political parties converge to the same position, that's actually regarded as a crisis of democracy. So in a way, this party politics perspective would expect differences between parties, and if there are no differences, that's a problem for democracy, and here on the public opinion side, it's just the reverse. So policymaking should be responsive to the average voter, and if there is party politics going on, it's sort of detracting the policymakers from implementing the public will of the people. And that's a little bit of the motivation in terms of the theory for the whole project, because both of these perspectives have value, empirical value and also normative value, so we try to see what's really going on. We, in a sense, these theories either overestimate or underestimate the role of public opinion. So if you look at this first big literature, which is about public opinion and policymaking, this is all about public opinion. Party politics is a minor issue that distracts maybe the influence of public opinion on policymaking, and the party politics literature and also the interest group literature that I haven't really talked that much about, it's just the reverse, because this is only about party politics and interest groups, and public opinion is not really looked at. And what we're trying to achieve here in the project is to better understand the interplay between these forces and to understand when public opinion matters and when party politics matters and when interest groups matters. And we think that all these three things matter to a certain extent. The important thing is that it's more an assumption, but if we're looking at our public opinion data, I think it's also an empirical finding, actually, that public opinion is a partly independent and exogenous force. So if you take the policy feedback argument to the extreme, it would suggest that public opinion is just reflecting policy legacies without really being an independent force. And if you go to the other extreme, and if you adapt the purely rational choice perspective, I guess you would say public opinion, public preferences, they come from socioeconomic conditions or exogenous forces and are not affected by the political context at all. That's sort of the other extreme position. And I think empirically, as always, it's some kind of middle ground that we find here, that sometimes the public opinion is affected by the institutional status quo, but in many times it's also independent of that. And And that is important because otherwise there's no use of studying public opinion if it's just completely endogenous or if it's completely coming out of either the policy status quo or whether it's completely whether political parties can manipulate it completely, then there's no need to study public opinion because party politicians could simply craft public opinion in a direction that they prefer. And then we don't need to study the influence of public opinion because it's completely absorbed, basically, by party politics. But what we find is that we assume for the theory, but we also find that it is partly independent. And so there is some value to understanding what the real influence of public opinion. And so we have these two dimensions in our framework, and that's basically the core of our argument for the book. And this one dimension is about the salience of an issue, and the other dimension is about the coherence of attitudes, of popular attitudes on that specific issue. And so the salience of an issue is very straightforward. It basically translated into everyday language, it just means how important is an issue in public debates. When it's highly salient, people talk a lot about it, they care a lot about it, it's discussed in the media, it's discussed in talk shows, it's discussed in the newspapers. If the salience is low, it's an issue which is only treated in expert circles behind closed doors and so on. But it's not something that is debated in the public so much. So that's one important dimension. And the second dimension is the coherence of attitudes on that specific issue. So whether people have a very coherent attitude, so both in terms of whether there's conflict, so whether there's a broad agreement within the population on that specific issue in terms of the scope of the majority behind a certain issue, but also whether there's polarization of attitude. So it's both a little bit. This is why we're saying coherent versus conflicting attitudes. It's not only about polarization of attitudes, but it's also about the size of the majority behind a certain issue. And these two dimensions make up these three different cells. And the easiest things to understand is this cell here, where you have a combination of high salience and coherent attitudes. In that case, the signal that public opinion is sending to the policymakers is loud and clear. There's really a coherent attitude on an issue. People talk about it. It's on the news. Everybody cares. So this is a very loud and clear signal. And this is why we call it loud politics. And here we expect the largest influence of public opinion because policymakers have a strong interest. Party politicians have a strong interest to respond to this loud and clear signal. And if interest groups have a divergent position, they probably have a hard time prevailing with that divergent position because it's such a loud and clear signal. And then the other sort of easy case is the field of quiet politics down here, where an issue has a low salience in the public. And that stretches across this other dimension simply because if people don't really care about a certain issue, they probably don't really have good opinions about it. So we don't really need to worry about whether attitudes are coherent or not, because if we measure some kind of attitudes for low salience issues, they might even be non-attitudes in the sense that you just measure something with a questionnaire, but to a certain extent this is a constructed measure because people just don't really care that much about that specific issue. And we know from the work of Pepper Culpepper and many others that in this field of quiet politics, when the public really doesn't care so much, interest groups are really important because a lot of stuff happens behind closed doors. Interest groups can have a lot of influence because they're experts on a certain issue. There are iron triangles and other forms of interest group coordination between the state and interest group actors. And so that's the field of quiet politics. And we actually will see later in the German case that this, in terms of the outcomes, it doesn't have to be a negative scenario. It can produce good outcomes overall, but it also can produce bad outcomes. But it's just to say that interest group influence as such is not necessarily a bad thing. It can also have beneficial outcomes. The most interesting case, I would say, is this field here over on this side, which combines high salience with conflicting attitudes, and this we call loud but noisy politics. So it basically is a situation where a lot of people talk about an issue, everybody's excited, there's a high salience, public debates, but there are conflicting attitudes. So there are no clear majorities, maybe attitudes are even polarized on a certain issue. And then we say this is the part where party politics dominates. So policymakers, because it's a highly salient issue, have to do something about it. They have to react to what the people are talking about, but it's not a clear signal. So depending on who is in government, depending on what kind of party is in charge, you can have this outcome or you can have that outcome. And then the balance of power is decisive, which majority, so to speak, prevails in the short term. And that's exactly what party politics argues and parties in theory and welfare state research argues. And so we basically have a framework here that allows to formulate hypotheses on when on the conditions when public opinion has a large influence on policymaking and when party politics dominates or when interest group politics dominates. And this is the empirical framework that we apply to our study. And in the first phase, as I said, we're looking at this public opinion in 8 Western European countries, really understanding, trying to understand how salient is education in these countries and how coherent are the attitudes in order to be able to connect it to the second part of the argument. And in the case studies then, we apply these different, we try to find examples for the different parts, and we actually find in all of the countries that we look at, we find examples within education policy for each of those. And it matches sort of with the hypothesis that we have. So coming to the survey, to provide you some with some background information on this, if you're more interested in the details, this is a paper that came out recently in the Journal of European Social Policy by myself and some co-authors, where we describe the survey in greater detail and also presents some descriptive findings. We did the survey in 8 European countries with almost 9,000 observations. We invested a lot of money to get a very good data quality, which is more or less comparable to the European Social Survey, which is in Europe at least the gold standard in terms of survey quality. We did telephone interviews, and this was done by a professional survey institute. It was done by native speakers, and we used this RDD procedure to also reach people who have only cell phones. And we have about 50 questions on education policy, or actually, I mean, there are also some control variables in there, of course, but we have a lot of questions on education policy, but also social investment policies more generally. And we have some experiments in there, and some of this I will show you later on, or now actually. And at some point this year, because the project is officially over soon, we will also make the data publicly available, so basically everybody can then go out and use it and see. Because even though we have some papers out on it now, it's still a lot of stuff that we haven't really studied. And as I mentioned, the case studies, we have these 4 detailed case studies in Germany, UK, Sweden, Spain, and we do some shadow case studies in the remaining 8 countries, Ireland, France, Italy, and Denmark. We're focusing on the last 10 years, trying to cover all education sectors from early childhood education via schools policy to vocational education and training and higher education. And we use the INVEDUC data. So INVEDUC comes from Investing in Education in Europe. That's the name of the project, to see what the state of public opinion is in that specific country and then connect it to our case studies. So this is some descriptive statistics from the survey. And this is just a very broad overview about how important education is in Europe. These are responses to the question of whether people would like to see more government spending in these different areas of the welfare state. And this is the share of people who respond, we want to see more or even much more spending on these different fields. And if you add it all up, so this is added up across all the different 8 European countries, and you can see that education comes out on top. So about 80% of people in Europe, in Western Europe, would like to see more or even much more spending on education. Healthcare is second in place. It's about 70%. But all the other big policies from the welfare state, pension, support for families, labor market policy, unemployment benefits, they come much further below. So that shows that education is a really, really important policy field. And given that much of the welfare state literature usually focuses on pensions or labor market policies, the more traditional parts of the welfare state, I think, and this is something that I've been saying for many years, welfare state research should really pay much more attention to education. And this just basically confirms it. What we also did in the survey is forcing respondents to prioritize. And that's something that you don't get in the standard surveys, such as the European Social Survey or the International Social Survey Program. We basically gave the same policy fields to the respondents again, but then we said, if you had to pick one, which one would you choose out of all of these? And then you see a lot of cross-national variation. And in Germany especially, support for education is very high, so focusing public spending on education is very high. In Italy, it's also pretty high. And healthcare is also very popular in many countries. In France, unemployment spending or labor market spending is very popular, and that reflects problems on the labor market in that country. In southern European countries, we have the same. But if you add it all up, and then if you don't believe me, you have to read the paper that I mentioned before. If you add it all up and apply population weights, education still comes out on top. So. because in Germany and Italy, education is really prioritized by the people. If you don't use population weights and just simply take an average across countries, healthcare is slightly ahead, but compared to all the other policy fields of the welfare state, it's still education and healthcare are sort of the top priorities for the citizens in Europe. What we then also did is to ask people for their spending support for different kinds of education. That's also something you don't get in the standard surveys that are available, whether they would like to see more investment in schools, in early childhood education, vocational education and training, VET, or higher education. And this also reveals quite strong differences across countries. In Germany, for example, people would like to see much more investment on schools and early childhood education. In France, it's all about VET. Interestingly, also in Spain, where you have lots of problems of youth unemployment, same in Italy. And so you can here already see that the country context matters with regard to what kind of education sector people really want to see more investment in. Sweden, much more investment in schools because they had really bad PISA scores in the last wave. So you see that the public does react to the current status quo, but it often reacts in a way that signals a willingness to change and not necessarily a willingness to just go on like before. Then this is another example from the survey. I'm just giving you some examples so that you see what kind of stuff is in there. This is demand for social investment policies, more broadly defined. Social investment policies would be support for an expansion of early childhood education, investments in active labor market policy and higher education. Then we have support for passive social transfers, which is actually mostly about pension spending, support for more generous pensions and early retirement, or workfare policies, support for strict conditionality in labor market policy, whether people want to have a stricter approach in giving people unemployment benefits. What was a little surprising to us that workfare policies are also very popular, actually, and that's something that probably many welfare state people don't really want to see like to discuss about, because it's basically confirming that there's also quite strong support for making the welfare state stricter or, in a way, retrenchment of welfare state benefits. And this is an analysis of the determinants of these different things, and I'm just showing you this in order to give you an assessment on this coherence of attitudes and what we mean when we talk about coherence of attitudes. And these are just estimate or regression analysis, and these point estimates are estimates of the marginal effects of these different micro-level variables. And here you can see that with regard to the social investment policies, you see rather broad support in the sense that there's not much conflict going on. You don't see a lot of significant effects here. It's all it's basically broadly supported across different age groups, and gender doesn't really matter. Income doesn't matter for support for social investment policies. What is mostly important is ideology. So economic left and liberal values, people holding these ideologies are very supportive of social investment. Highly educated people, for some strange reason which we can't really explain, the elderly are also supportive of social investment, but we can talk more about this in the Q&A. But in the, for the passive transfers and the workfare policies, we see the more classical welfare state coalitions. So we see traditional welfare state clientele groups, low educated, low income people with economic left wing but social right wing values supporting the passive transfers. For the workfare, we see high income people with conservative values and economic right wing values supporting workfare policies. So there you see there's much more conflict in terms of the attitudes. And this is just an example of how we think about this issue of coherence of attitudes. This is an example from the governance section of the survey where we look at many different things regarding the governance of schools, what kind of role private schools and private universities should play, whether the state should fund private schools, whether there should be free school choice, whether people would like to see more decentralization of schools, whether they would like to see more comprehensive schooling or more tracking in schools, whether the employers should be more engaged in vocational education and training. And I'm just saying this is a preview because we actually in the middle of analyzing this data and looking at country-specific patterns and also the determinants of this data. And so I cannot really show you, don't have the time to show you more details on this. But just to show that, again, there's a lot of variation. Some policies are very popular. Comprehensive schooling is surprisingly popular across these European countries. Private schools and universities are not very popular, and privatization is not very popular, especially if the state should pay for that. But the employer-provided vocational education and training is actually quite popular. So people, especially in countries where they don't have a strong VAT system, are very in favor of expanding employer involvement in VAT. And then finally, I think maybe just a little thing here, and we can talk more about it in the Q&A because I really want to also talk about the case study. We also looked at trade-offs in spending support, and this is the experimental part of the survey where we where we basically split the sample into four equally sized groups, and each group gets a slightly different question, and then you see what happens to support for education spending when you face people with different kinds of constraints. And here we got really strong treatment effects, which was quite surprising to me that these effects are very strong. So this is from a paper that got published last year. And it shows that when you ask, this is the level of support you get when you just ask people, do you want to see more spending on education? It's very similar to the question we asked before, and you get about 72% who say, yes, let's spend more on education. But then if you say, well, these are different people, right, because we split the sample in four different groups, so everybody becomes just one version of this question. So in the second group, we ask people, do you want more spending on education, even if that means higher taxes? And then you see already a pretty big drop in support to just 48%. If you say, well, even if you have to accept higher levels of public debt, this drops to 41%. But the biggest drop in support is if you say that would go along with cuts in other parts of the welfare state, especially pensions, then you only have 26% of the people who support education spending. And that really shows the difficulty of reforming welfare states, mature welfare states, because if you want to expand some part of the welfare state, you always have to make cutbacks or increase taxes, because we are not in the expansion phase of the welfare state anymore. We are in the retrenchment phase, or at least in the silver age of the welfare state, as Peter Taylor-Gooby called it. So I think this is really important in order to understand what's going on. And we actually, if you then look at the determinants of this, you can see differences across these different groups. And to cut a longer story short, what really comes out is that if it's about the size of the welfare state, so whether people want to see more education spending without any constraints, you really see that the classical cleavages, left-right ideology, income, educational background really matter. But if it's about redistribution within the welfare state, from pensions to education, all the stuff doesn't matter anymore. It's really only about interest, self-interest more narrowly defined. So retired people are obviously not very much in favor of cutting back pensions, but students and families with small kids at home, they would still like to see more education spending, even if that means cutting back pensions. And we just have another paper where we use a different trade-off question that just came out in the European Sociological Review a couple of weeks ago, basically confirming that this is going on. So I want to have at least a couple of minutes to talk about the case studies so that you get an idea of what we want to do with the case studies. And I'm using the case of Germany as an example here, and we do similar case studies in these other countries that I mentioned. Just to give you some very brief background on the German education system, much of it you probably already know. It's a strong federalist country, especially in education policy, so Länder are the regional governments, are very important in education policy making. There's very limited competencies left for the federal government, mostly in vocational education and training, a little bit in early childhood education and higher education. We have a strong tradition in Germany of segmented secondary school systems with traditionally three different tiers, a Hauptschule, Realschule, Gymnasium, and students get sorted onto these different tracks at a very early age, at the age of 11. And once you are on the track, it's very difficult to change that track. We have a very strong tradition of apprenticeship training, collective skill formation system, rather small higher education system and limited opportunities for early childhood education. But this has expanded quite significantly in recent years, both higher education and early childhood education. So this is what the survey data looks like for Germany, and this is just to give you an impression of how we use the survey data to form expectations regarding the salience and coherence of attitudes on these different issues. And so here we have the survey data and how the average look for the country as a whole, and also how the average for different partisan groups look like. So for supporters from left-wing parties, right-wing parties, we now have a much more complex party system in Germany than 10, 15 years ago, with by now six parties in the parliament. And so you can immediately see that there are some issues which are where attitudes are very conflictual, like here, but this is actually about education spending versus other social policies, about the distribution of spending across these different sectors of the education system, and especially about the governance issues. There's much more conflictual attitudes here on the question, put pressure on employers to provide opportunities for VT. You see a really strong difference here between attitudes across these parties and groups. And in other cases, especially on spending issues, you see not so much of a spread of attitudes. So we try to use the data to see how salient is education and how conflictual are the attitudes, how coherent are the attitudes. And then we have three case or examples for each of the three boxes that I introduced above. And as an example for loud politics, I want to introduce this the field of early childhood education. We have seen a huge expansion of early childhood education in Germany for children below the age of three in recent years. So this is data from a recent report from the Federal Ministry. You see that in 2008 we had about 360 places for children below the age of three, and in 2014 it's almost doubled to 660,000 within 8 years, and it's been going up since 2014. So there's really quite a strong expansion, and I would say This is a very clear example of a loud, clear, and coherent signal from public opinion, because there people really were demanding, or and still are demanding, especially the middle classes, more investment in early childhood education, and policymakers have largely reacted to this. And even the Conservative Party, especially the CDU, the Christian Democratic Party on the federal level, has become more supportive on the expansion of early childhood education and family policies, really in order to appeal to these urban middle classes, basically what the average voter wants in a way. So that's a very nice example of how you see a more traditional left-wing issue, which is the expansion of early childhood education, has been to become a broader issue, which is also supported by conservative parties. And one important event in that regard was the establishment of a statutory right for a place in public daycare for children below the age of three, which was decided in 2013. So now there is a right for everybody to have a place in formal childcare, and this was introduced by a CDU minister, basically. So this is really a strong signal that something's going on and that the dynamic is not partisan anymore, but it's really a dynamic that's much, much broader than that. If you look at the pattern of expansion, there's basically no difference. Doesn't matter which government is in power. So now, as you might know, we have another grand coalition government in Germany. But in between, we had a so-called black-yellow coalition, a conservative-liberal coalition. And even in that time, basically, when the conservative bourgeois parties were in power, you still had the same expansion going on. So this is an example of a loud and clear signal from public opinion and policymakers reacting to this. As a small afterthought, I did a study with a former student of mine where we looked at the lender level, and you still actually see quite significant differences across the lender in terms of how far or how quickly the lender have moved. And there you do see the old party politics pattern emerging again. So lender governed by the left have been still much more active in promoting the expansion of early childhood education, but on the background of a very upward trend. This is exactly what we're trying to understand. There is a loud and clear signal, expand early childhood education, but some party variation nevertheless. But still, it's a good example for loud politics, I think. Quiet politics, this is the case of vocational education and training. And as I said before, dual apprenticeship training is very important in Germany. It's a system where apprentices are trained in firms and also get some theoretical education in vocational schools. Employers' associations and trade unions are very important in the system, and Kathy has worked a lot on this as well. Historically, these actors have worked together with the state in order to establish a corporatist framework, and this has been actually, after some conflicts in the beginning, this has been very consensual and very based on a broad support between employers and unions and in the population. So basically everybody's happy with the system and it works pretty fine, pretty well, and the youth unemployment is very low in Germany. General unemployment now actually is also quite low. So this is a good example of quiet politics, because everybody is sort of happy. Nobody really discusses about VAT reform. But actually there are some problems in the VAT system, because students with low school qualifications and, of course, young people with a migration background, they have a very hard time getting a training place in the firm-based training system. And so in the last 15 to 20 years, you have a new sector that has emerged alongside the dual apprenticeship training system, the so-called transition sector, which takes care of all the people who fail to get a training place. And this sector has grown quite a lot, and it's in size, at some point, it was actually as large as the dual training system in terms of the number of students who go either to vocational training or to the transition system. Now, because of the good labor market development, it has shrunk again. But still, it's still a problem. But since this is a low salience issue, and these young people with weak school qualifications don't have a strong political lobby, nobody really addresses that issue seriously. Of course, unions try to do something about it, but the government and employers, they don't really want to do anything about it. And so what happened in recent years is there was actually a big evaluation of the last reform of the vocational training system, although it in the end it turned out that was actually not really such a big thing, because the report commission was commissioned by the ministry, and basically, again, the report showed this is a great system, we don't really need to change anything. So, employers were happy with this, and unions sort of had to go along with it. The government was happy with it, and the public didn't really care. So that's an issue of quiet politics, and I can cite many other examples from VAT policy, where you can really see that interest groups working together with the state sort of have the system in under control, and there's not much loud politics or public debate going on here, and interest groups are really running the show together with state actors. And as I said before, that doesn't have to be a bad thing, because for most people the system is great, it works, except for those people who fail to get a training place. But so that's a good example of quiet politics. And finally, loud but noisy politics, which I think is the most interesting case. And here we have to go to the lender level, because loud and noisy politics happen in school reform debates. As I said before, we have this long history of segmented secondary schools with the three different tiers. But this is basic nowadays, actually, this very traditional system only is in place in Bavaria. All the other Länder have moved away from it to a certain extent, some more radically than others. And why? Because people start to realize that this produces a lot of educational inequalities. And there is also demographic pressure, because student numbers are declining, and which has very bad consequences for the lower tier, the Hauptschule, because nobody really wants to go there anymore. So something has to be done. And what is happening now, we see a general trend towards a two-tiered model, where you have two types of schools. The gymnasium will stay more or less as it is, but you have one integrated comprehensive school type alongside the gymnasium, which is, there are different models, different names across the different Länder, but basically the idea is that you merge the lower tiers, the Hauptschule and the Realschule, into this new school type. This has been a very conflictual issue in many of the Länder. And I think, even though our Inveduk data shows that there's a lot of support for comprehensive education in principle, you actually see that there's much more, there's a much stronger divide in terms of a public opinion on what to do about this, and especially when it comes to the implementation part, where, you know, many parents might support comprehensive education in principle, but when it's about their own children who should go to a comprehensive school, they probably are not that happy about it anymore. And so this is why we expect that in this field party politics should dominate, and this is exactly what we find. And here, this is an example of the introduction of the so-called Gemeinschaftsschule in Baden-Württemberg, and I also did a similar study in Nordrhein-Westphalia, which is also a very large state in Germany, and you have very similar dynamics here. Baden-Württemberg is a traditionally very conservative state in south of Germany. For more or less idiosyncratic circumstances, the Greens got in power in 2011 and formed a coalition with the Social Democrats. The first time this happened in Germany, and this is the first time that the left has been in power in Baden-Württemberg since the Second World War. So this is really a very conservative state, but they really started to implement a very ambitious education reform agenda right away. So that's party politics, right? So as soon as the majority changes, then they start doing a reform. And as you can imagine, this led to a lot of conflict and a lot of discussions about this structural reforms. What they really did was this merger of the two lower tiers of the traditional segmented system by forming this new school type. But actually, it was a rather voluntary and bottom-up process, because they didn't just say, we have now a new school type and everybody has to go to the school. They just made available additional funding for this new school type, and then individual schools could apply to get themselves transformed from a traditional school into the new school. But even that led to a lot of conflict, and there were strong supporters like the governing parties and progressive teacher unions, but lots of opposition from the conservative parties, as you would expect, but also from conservative teacher unions. It was very loud and noisy politics, lots of party conflict. But in the end, they went through with it, and that's exactly what we would expect from a party politics perspective. Once you have the majority, you do your thing, and then even though it might lead to conflicts. So basically, we have examples for all of these things, and we can also find that for the other cases that we're looking at, and it more or less fits with our hypothesis that when you have coherent and high salient attitudes, public opinion matters. When there are conflicting attitudes but high salience, party politics dominates, and when you have an issue of low salience, it's really more about interest groups politics. So to come up with conclusions, what is the role of public opinion was the initial question. Our preliminary answer is that it really depends on these two things, salience on coherence of attitudes. We have tried to develop a framework that can explain the conditions, that has hypotheses about under which conditions public opinion matters. And we want to understand how these three things play and interact with each other. And I think this, on the one hand, we want to contribute to a better understanding of the role of public opinion in policymaking more broadly, which can also be applied to other policy fields. But of course, we are also interested in better understanding what goes on in education policy reform in Europe. And I think there are some implications in terms of inequality of political voice, even if public opinion matters, it's mostly issues that are very important to the middle class, I would say. So it's not really something that is, you could see this with the example of VAT versus school reforms. It's still really a question of who has the most voice when it comes to public opinion. All right, so thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Marius Busemeyer, professor of political science at the University of Konstanz, Germany. Professor Busemeyer's lecture was titled A Loud But Noisy Signal, The Role of Public Opinion in Education Policy Making, and was presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Center for the Study of Europe director, Kathy Jo Martin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.